Clive Brook. I've called today's program Mightier Than the Sword. The pen is mightier than the sword, or so the saying goes. The pen to which I'm referring is the forger's pen. However, when the sword concerned is the sword of Damocles, then, as many of the inmates of His Majesty's prisons will agree, the sword is mightier than the pen. So be it. Let us start our program by visiting a place which has provided us in the past with a source of inspiration. I refer to that sinister but fascinating place, the Black Museum of Scotland Yard. With the ever-increasing amount of scientific aid which is provided for our modern police force, the art of forging has, I'm happy to say, fallen into decline. What hope has one poor forger against X-rays, ultraviolet rays, and all the other paraphernalia of the Metropolitan Police Laboratory to find what one might term some really juicy examples of the forger's art? One must turn back the calendar some 40 years and take a look at a few of the older exhibits of the Black Museum. Here, for instance, inside this glass case, we see a number of moles and plates. These were originally used for printing banknotes of the unofficial variety.
That's right, Mr. Brook. Russian rubles. That's the base of hope.
Ah, yes, that was a very famous case. The forger who specialized in Russian ruble notes was a versatile sort of chap. Not only did he print notes, he also used to write notes. Nice, delicate little notes to old ladies, threatening them that if they didn't send him money, he would at the earliest opportunity place dynamite on their doormats. So that the first time they rubbed their boots or galoshes, well, he wouldn't venture to say where they'd be blown to. Eventually, after a long and extremely successful career, he went for an extended and enforced vacation. Up Dartmoor way, I believe. And here, in the same glass case, are some relics of one of the most famous of all forgers. His name was Charles Howard. Let me tell you his story. Old Howard, for he was over 70 years of age, was a colossal swindler. He played for high stakes and the highest quarters. No tuppenny halfpenny swindles would appease his criminal appetite. Thousands and nothing short was his game. And more often than not, he bagged them. His operations extended all over the civilized world.
Ah, my dear Mrs. Fraser, I would so like you to meet a friend of mine.
I'm always happy to meet a friend of yours. Please introduce us.
Mrs. Fraser, Count von Howard.
Charmed, my dear lady.
Count,
Von Howard.
Howard?
Yes. H-O-W-A-R-D.
How strange.
Yes, my mother was German, my father English.
Oh, of course, how silly of me. Tell me, Count von Howard, do you often come to affairs of this kind?
I'm afraid I'm not very often in Paris. You see, my business takes me all over the place.
Please forgive my curiosity, but what is your business? Such a distinguished-looking man, I feel sure it must be something quite fascinating.
Quite prosaic, I'm afraid, my dear lady. You might say I earn my living by my pen.
But how wonderful. Fiction?
Mainly. You see, it pays the best. Would it be presumptuous if I asked you to dance this waltz with me?
Good heavens, no. I should be delighted. Such a distinguished man, a count and an author.
Howard was a benevolent, distinguished-looking gentleman. His plausibility was simply delicious. His impudence at facing a thing out, in spite of immense odds against him, was undeniably tremendous. He was a man of infinite capacity, though like most of the rogues in his profession, he always tried the same trick once to... Perhaps his best-known speciality was the forged will case. He usually began with a discreetly worded advertisement in a newspaper, perhaps the Manchester Guardian or the Times.
Will any person related or having knowledge of living relations of the late Mr. W. Clark of London, formerly resident in the north of England, supply to the undermentioned address when they will learn something to their advantage? Please supply full details of your presumed relationship to the deceased, etc., etc. Yes, I think that will do quite nicely.
In the north of England apply to the undermentioned address when they will learn something to their advantage. Please supply full details of your presumed relationship to the deceased.
Well, I suppose there's no harm in writing. After all, my name is Clark. Yes. Yes, I'll drop him a line.
Well,
referenced your letter of the 20th out. The information you supply, while interesting, is not conclusive. As you are no doubt aware, the late Mr. Clark died leaving some £105,000 to be divided among his 20 nearest relations. I should, in addition, mention that Mr. Clark stipulated in his will that his fortune should not go to persons of affluence, but to people of small means. Obviously, as executors of the late Mr. Clark's estate, we are not in a position to charge to this estate the necessary research inquiries in connection with these people who claim to be his relations. If you desire to proceed further in this matter, I should be glad if you would forward by return the sum of £2.10 on account of the necessary research and inquiry fees. We look forward to receiving your further instructions.
And who wouldn't be one of the 20 happy relations for the expenditure of a mere 50 shillings? A bargain if ever I heard one.
Dear sir, further to my letter of the 23rd of August, it is now some 8 weeks since I wrote to you in connection with Mr. Clark and enclosed a postal order for £2.10 in respect of research and inquiry fees. I should be glad if you could let me have some news of how this matter is progressing.
No answer. Curtain. Mr. Howard was a great one for ingenuity. His clients, for it was in those terms that he always referred to his victims, certainly got something for their investment, even if it were only a momentary feeling of excitement. He was sufficient of a psychologist to know that a man is always at his most gullible when he thinks that good fortune is with him.
Yes, sir. With reference to our correspondence on the subject of the late Mr. William Clark, who departed this life on April the 9th, 1897, I attach a true and certified copy of the inscription on his tombstone, which, as you will see, bears out the information which we supplied to you. I should be glad to hear from you in due course with a further remittance in respect of the preliminary legal steps to enforce your claim under his will.
Sometimes it was James Hill Cooper Clark who died worth $100,000. Other times, William Clark, who left a mere $5,000. But old Howard obviously had an affection for the Clarks. He was sufficient of an artist never to use a name like Smith, Brown, or even Jones. There were plenty of Clarks, plenty enough to provide a good living for old Howard. But it was a name that had a ring of authenticity. Not the sort of name you'd find in a hotel register under false pretenses. A good, sound, authentic name. But all good things come to an end, even the career of old Howard. His last fling took him back to his happiest hunting ground, High Life on the Continent. Same man, same profession, but a different name, or rather, a different version of an old name.
My dear Danto Vardi, how nice to see you.
The pleasure is mutual, I assure you. As a matter of fact, Monsieur Picot, you are the very man I have been looking for.
And why is that?
Why, I can't really talk here. Let us go in the corner there. It's rather confidential.
Now, do tell me. I'm so curious.
You have no doubt heard of Miss Annabel Walton.
Walton? Walton? I can't say that I have. Where does she come from?
Australia, my dear Picot. And she's fabulously rich. It so happens that I am an old friend of the family. I knew her father extremely well. Miss Walton arrived in Paris last week with a letter of introduction to me. I promised to look after her.
Oh, but how interesting. She's very rich.
£1,000,000. And beautiful, too. And extremely impressionable.
I should like to meet her.
I thought you would. There's, however, a little formality, you see. I'm in rather a spot of bother at the moment. Purely temporary, of course. I was wondering if you could help me with a small loan.
How small?
Ah, a man after my own heart. Well, now, let's get down to business.
Dear. Years in the business and still capable of making a mistake. You see, in the past, all of Howard's victims had been honest, if somewhat gullible, people. The trouble with Howard's final trick was that it depended on his taking advantage of people who might, and probably were, just as crooked-minded as himself.
But I tell you, this woman, she does not even exist. Annabel Wharton, no such name, no such person.
Hmm. And you gave Howard money?
Yes, yes.
Why?
Well, I wanted to meet the lady.
For what purpose?
I just wanted to meet her.
I see. Well, Mr. Picot, thank you for the information. I'm not sure that we can take any action against Monsieur Howard, but in any case, he's returned to England. I think you have told me enough of Mr. Howard's past life to make it worthwhile to pass this information to Scotland Yard.
This is an outrage, having a man arrested under false pretenses. I shall write to the Times about it. I shall write to the Times.
But the days of old Howard's letter writing were over. In future, his correspondence was limited to two letters a month written on stationery supplied by a watchful government. But if old Howard was retired, his reputation, and as you shall hear, his profession, lived on. Speciality was the begging letter. Your true begging letter writer is certainly entitled to join the family circle of forgers, though in most cases only as a distant cousin. What a begging letter writer Howard would have made. But there are men and women whose talents in this direction are just as fine, if not so varied. Over here in the corner of the Back Museum is a whole cupboard full of examples of this particular form of art. Let's take a look at some of them.
Taking this opportunity of writing to you at your club, for which I trust you will forgive me. As an old soldier, I feel that we have something in common, and having actually served in your regiment, I feel that you will appreciate my sad predicament. I attach a brief summary of my army career, which will show you that I have some grounds for presuming to call you a friend. I am in grave financial difficulties, and would appreciate your help. My situation is this. My small daughter...
As my Member of Parliament, in the hope that you will appreciate the feelings of a young man on the threshold of life, owing to family difficulties, it has not been possible to complete my education, and in my present job I cannot give sufficient time to study. A loan, the sum of £10, will tide me over my present difficulties, and I would be prepared to give you my word of honor to faithfully...
I am a widow with two children. My husband is lying dangerously ill at home, and I am writing to you in desperation for assistance. As proof of my honesty, I enclose a receipt for last month's rent. Nothing horrifies me more than getting into debt.
The receipt is a museum piece, but its value is somewhat lessened by the fact that the files of Scotland Yard contain some 40 of these letters, and each one of them contains a receipt for the same month's rent. Your begging letter writer is never at a loss for proof of his honesty. The memory of the greatest genius the begging letter world has ever known is kept green at New Scotland Yard. He's believed to be dead. But if he were out of prison, London would soon hear of him. We will hide his identity for the sake of his friends and relations who may have survived him under the unassuming name of Brown. Brown was an old fellow with a glorious white head of hair and always dressed in black cloth. His great forte was his ability to write in assumed hands. He could write in 100 different ways, for which purpose he was aided by a variety of pen nibs and various colored inks. He was a man of great system. To those whom he trusted, he would proudly show his artist equipment.
These little red books, you see, are divided into various sections. This one, for instance, has names and addresses of members of the House of Lords. This one, members of the House of Commons, with some indication of their party affiliation and financial resources. This set of volumes is entirely devoted to widows, subdivided according to place of residence and income group. You see, in every case, I give a kind of progress report on results. Besides that, there's a little biographical background, age, history, and etc., etc. And, where possible, too, a few notes concerning character. Let me show you. Yes. Here we have the Marchioness of Westminster, 91 years old, and a widow for 19 years. System. I always believe in system. It's so much safer that way.
Yes, Mr. Brown certainly believed in system. And so does Scotland Yard. For here, carefully preserved in the Black Museum, are those same little red Mr. Brown's works. Here's rather a nice one. A heartwarming appeal to the generosity of a peer of the realm. This accompanied by a letter on black-edged paper, signed by a clerk.
That Mrs. Anne Clark, widow, carried on business as laundress in this parish for several years, and has hitherto supported a large family in respectability. On the afternoon of Saturday, the 14th day of December, while Mrs. Clark was delivering clean linen with her horse and van near the Streatham railway station, the horse took fright at the whistle of a passing train and started off at a furious pace. When coming in contact with a coal wagon, the horse was killed, the van dashed to pieces, and her eldest son, 16 years of age, was thrown from the van, receiving such injury as caused compound fracture of the right thigh, and now lies in St. Thomas's Hospital in a dangerous state, whereby Mrs. Clark has sustained a severe loss, estimated at £45. Knowing Mrs. Clark, a respectable and industrious widow with a family of 5 children depending on her.
Signed, of course, by Mr. Brown. Strange to say, not in his own name. Invariably, the letter would be accompanied by a subscription list showing those kind-hearted people who had already made a donation. Mr. Brown had a vivid imagination, and the list was always headed by the same name. You'll recall that a coal wagon was the cause of the calamity. First on the list, therefore, came the name of a famous firm of London coal merchants who, with remarkable generosity, without fail, could be counted on for a contribution of £2. System, system. But system, as you will hear, can in the end cause the destruction of its creator. Mr. Brown got his system mixed up and made the mistake of writing to the same person twice running.
Here's a funny case. Came in the mail this morning.
What is it, sir?
The elderly gentleman living in St. John's Wood had a letter from an old friend asking for money.
Nothing very strange about that, sir.
No, I agree. Funny thing was, he had 2 letters in the same week.
From different people?
Yes. Different names and handwriting. But here's the funny part. The wording's identical.
Remarkable.
Yeah. I think we'll follow this one up.
Yes, sir.
And follow it up they did. Exit Mr. Brown. Cut. I would not want entirely to spoil your faith in human nature. The next time you get a letter from a friend in need, don't be too cynical about it. All the same, make sure it is a friend and that he is in need. I began this program by talking not about begging letter writers, but about the more prosaic kind of forger. Don't think that the forger is restricted to making authentic copies of His Majesty's currency. Have you ever heard the expression, a flash note? No? Well, listen to this.
Flash note, sir? Why, they're currency printed to look sufficiently like the real thing to deceive somebody who's just got a casual glimpse of a wad of notes. Now, when you take a look at the notes themselves, you'll find they have some silly wording on them like Bank of Common Sense. Of course, the trouble is that all too often, the mug doesn't take a look at them. He just sees them in the crook's wallet and takes it for granted that they're the real thing.
And that simplicity, which is characteristic of not a few of the inhabitants of Britain, and the readiness with which some people are taken in, are well illustrated by New Scotland Yard's collection of flash notes. Flash notes are generally carried by members of that fraternity who delight in showing you what is known as the 3-card trick. or by persons who wish for some particular reasons of their own to inspire your confidence in them. You may recall from a previous program the classic in confidence tricks, the rosary.
That's all right, old man. I trust you. I can see you're an honest fellow. But all the same, you can't be too careful.
Oh, I quite agree. Yes, you're right. You can't be too careful. I'll tell you what. Before we do the deal, why don't you try each other out?
How do you mean?
Well, we're all strangers to one another. At least we were a week ago. Though I feel we're all pretty good friends now, eh?
Yeah.
Well, why don't you give your wallet to this gentleman here? Let him go for a walk around the block, say, for 15 minutes.
Well, all right. Although there's rather a lot of money in it.
Yeah, you mean you don't trust our friend?
Of course I trust him.
I say, you have got a lot of money in there.
£500. All right, here you are. We'll wait here for you. Don't forget, 15 minutes.
And 15 minutes later, our friend the mug comes back with a wallet containing the £500. Needless to say, not so lucky when his friend takes his wallet for an airing. Admittedly, there are only £25 in it, but the difference is that they are 25 real pounds.
There are several hundreds of these notes at New Scotland Yard. It's not a punishable offence, by the by, to have them in your possession, or even to print them. But it would go badly with you should you try to pass one as a real note. Now, it's a certain fact that in the case of many of these notes, they were never intended for any wrong purpose, but were merely brought out as a novel and attractive advertisement. But your confidence man, your card sharper, should any perchance happen to fall into his hands, uses them to suit his own game. They're crisp, just like real banknotes, and when rustled in the palm of the hand, make that delicious sound which cheers the heart and wreathes the face and minds. They're getting within the same size, too, with a real fiver. So they're used for the purpose for which they were never intended. And the confidence man pulls out of his trousers pocket a handful of, what, banknotes? Nothing of the kind. But they look like them. Of course they do. But if you get hold of them yourself, you'd see that this crisp piece of paper with a big 10 in the left-hand corner was only Bank of Engraving. I promise to engrave and print in letterpress, etc., on demand for the sum of £10 in the first style of the art of forfeit the above sum. London, 29th of April, 1840. For Self & Co., Bank of Engraving, J. Duck, Fitzroy Square.
There you are. Next time somebody flashes a roll of banknotes in front of you, just take a second look. Of course, they may be real, but you never know. Yes, sometimes the pen is mightier than the sword, but not always. Well, that's all for now, but I'll be back again soon to tell you some more of the secrets of Scotland Yard. Meanwhile, this is Clive Brooks saying goodbye and pleasant dreams. Thank you.